Hi, I'm Stephanie Lemick, and this is Building Trauma-Informed Workplaces. I am so thrilled to have another amazing guest joining us today to talk a little bit about something that's pretty common and has been pretty common through the pandemic and the several years after the pandemic, and that's career transitions and kind of the highs and lows of that experience. And it's something I've even experienced myself during that time frame. So thrilled to have you here with us. Kyle, I would love if you go ahead and introduce yourself to our listeners. I'm so thrilled to have you here. I should call you Dr. Kyle. It's so official. If I were a doctor, I would like talk about it all the time. So Dr. Kyle.
Yes. No, I'm
welcome
Kyle.
To the podcast.
Yes, I'm
and
Kyle.
Would love to have you introduce yourself.
Of course. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here. I'm a career coach. I primarily work with tech executives. And with that work, something that comes up so often, as you can imagine, is trauma in the workplace, trauma in their lives, both. I was a few minutes late today because I was supporting a client as they were navigating how do they recover through a traumatic workplace. So I'm excited to be speaking with you and the audience about navigating those career transitions and the role that trauma can play and how do you care for yourself through that process.
Amazing. Oh, I'm so excited. Yes, this is going to be such an amazing conversation. I'm curious, and I'm sure our listeners are curious too. How did you end up becoming a career coach, and how did you land in the space not only of doing career coaching, but doing it in a trauma-informed way with awareness around not only trauma overall, but also that really tricky topic of, for a lot of us, trauma we've experienced as a result of our workplaces?
Yes, I fell into career coaching 100% by accident. I literally started on Fiverr, charging $5 to review resumes, to write the summary part of people's LinkedIn profile. Over the years, it grew. My dad's advice, he doesn't remember this, but my mom does, was to double my prices each time I had a wait list. So I doubled my prices. It turned from just this college side hustle to really a small business. Fast forward 5 or 6 years, and I was doing this side business, probably 30 hours a week on top of my full-time job at a university. And I had to make the decision, do I keep working at a university or do I leave to pursue this? And I renewed my contract at the university. And then a month later, I went back to my boss and said, oh, can I unrenew this? I'm going to go pursue this resume writing business. And I was good at the resume writing, but I didn't love it. I really found the love was coaching people when they would say, okay, great, Kyle, we're talking about my resume, but what about my career? What about the interviews? What about once I land the job? Now what? How are you going to help me? And I shifted to career coaching. And then another theme that came up was trauma. People saying, I'm having trauma in the workplace, or trauma from my past workplace, or trauma from my life that's impacting my career. And I really focused on that because I've had my own experiences with trauma and ended up writing my doctoral dissertation on the role of mental health and storytelling. So it all just came together beautifully. And I've really focused my time lately on the role of trauma when it comes up for people in their careers.
Absolutely. My new catchphrase, I just came up with it in the last couple of weeks. I think my new catchphrase is, when you're dealing with people, you're dealing with trauma. And there are lots of statistics. There's lots of information that I share quite a bit, but I think that boils it down so well is when you're dealing with people, when you're interacting with people, you are also dealing with interacting with trauma. And sometimes it's, you know, in your face, it's very prominent, very present. And a lot of times, and a lot of the most tricky times, it is not, it's kind of this underlying thing. And sometimes we don't even recognize it in ourselves. I know I didn't recognize my trauma responses showing up in the workplace. So not that I'm the end all be all, you know, when I was in HR, I'd have awareness of trauma, but even folks who are informed, sometimes it's hard to kind of pull out of yourself and have that sense of self-awareness. So amazing. Oh, I'm thrilled. So grateful that you're doing this work. I think there are a lot of coaches out there. There are a lot of very good coaches out there. There are some coaches who are not my favorite. Mm-hmm. I think anyone who kind of wades in the coaching water can appreciate that. But there are really only a handful of coaches who I would truly consider trauma-informed, mm-hmm. who really have the credential, the commitment, the understanding mm-hmm. of what that means. So I am super thrilled to have you share a little bit more. And, you know, since we're talking about that, you know, what does it mean to you to say that, you know, you approach coaching in a trauma-informed manner, or you're a trauma-informed coach?
Yeah, as you shared, to be human is to experience trauma. All of us have experienced some level of trauma, whether it's COVID, whether it's the death of a loved one, whether it was childhood bullying, whether mm-hmm. it was in our family, there's trauma there. Oftentimes in the coaching space, especially in the career coaching space, people will have had a singular or maybe a few experiences landing a job or with trauma mm-hmm. and then feel like they're an expert. And while lived experience can be really helpful, that doesn't make you an expert in a topic. So I think it's important that people are also certified or credentialed yes. in what they're doing because coaching is currently an unregulated industry. So for me, it was attending multiple trainings and programs, pursuing my doctorate in adult education. So I'm aware of that in the role that trauma comes up. So I'm not just saying, okay, here's my singular experience of what trauma looks like for me and applying that to everyone else, because that's not the case. And it's not
plus 8 million to that.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. It's so interesting where people say, here's what's worked for me. Let me apply it to everyone else. When we're not,
that's
all
not coaching.
It's not coaching.
It's also not coaching. Yeah.
It's not coaching because it's not supposed to be just giving advice. Right. And it's not therapy either. Oftentimes people right. say, Kyle, I feel like you're my therapist. Okay. And I'm not a therapist. And they always say, yes, I know you're not a therapist. And they'll even say that before I do, because clients know I'm very careful to indicate I'm not a therapist. I'm not treating people. I'm not diagnosing people. Oftentimes, as you and I have talked about, trauma-informed coaching is really being aware and informed of their trauma, mm-hmm. honoring and recognizing it, saying, how do we navigate or cope with feelings that come up? And then often setting it aside so then we can focus on the work ahead, whether it's a career transition, a career move, dealing with an interview, all of that. But really, my job isn't to process that trauma with you. That's more of the work of a therapist.
I want to like throw a parade for you right now. That was such a perfect answer. And we did not prepare this. I just I was like, Kyle, here's this random question I'm asking you. It's like the most perfect answer. And what I love is the precision of the language you used. And I think sometimes, especially folks who are not, you know, living in this world of coaching, of trauma-informed, of therapy, all of these practices, a lot of people are like, wow, you know, you're really... When someone is super precise with their language, they're like, huh, like you're being really specific. I think that's unnecessary. It's actually wildly necessary mm-hmm. because these are lines that can become very blurry. Mm-hmm. And when we blur lines, when it comes to working with people's mm-hmm. identity, their mental health, their career health, mm-hmm. their financial health, and that gets into coaching, therapy, all of these things, that you can accidentally do harm. If you are playing in waters where you're not credentialed to be. And like you said, coaching can become tricky because credentialing in coaching is the Wild West. Mm-hmm. We don't have firm understanding. There's no single credentialing body. There are some credentialing bodies out mm-hmm. there, but there's no single, hey, to be a coach, you have to do mm-hmm. these things. So if like, I'm going to cut this little piece of this conversation out of the podcast at some point and say, if you're looking for a coach, look for someone who speaks about coaching using this specific language mm-hmm. because that to me keys up, okay, this person understands mm-hmm. and really takes seriously the fact that people are, you know, putting their career, their identity, their life into your mm-hmm. hands, and they're not monkeying around with mm-hmm. things that they shouldn't be doing. I love that so much. Somehow, Kyle, I like you even more now. And we're only like 10 minutes into the podcast. Thanks. I have a feeling that it'll only be even more by the end of this. So.
And I love what you said about the blurred lines, because with trauma mm-hmm. particularly, people are used to having their lines blurred. Trauma is mm-hmm. that experience where often you have something that is incomprehensible, something mm-hmm. that blurred your boundaries, blurred your perception of reality. So coaching is a space where, if done in a way that protects you as much as possible, no space can be perfectly safe, but that protects you and says, okay, here's the lines, let's make them clear. And oftentimes coaches, if they're not properly trained, if they don't take a trauma-informed approach, sometimes those lines can be blurred and then recreate unintentionally, oftentimes unconsciously, that trauma that people have had, and then they can be re-traumatized again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, so perfect. Well, I know we want to talk about career transitions. Mm-hmm. I know this is something you are super passionate about. You have a lot of experience helping folks navigate big career transitions. Mm-hmm. And holy moly, have we seen folks experience huge career transitions over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, you know, myself included. I went from being an in-house HR executive to independent consultant, entrepreneur, and now founding the Wounded Workforce and doing this work around trauma-informed workplaces. Yeah. There's overlaps, but that's a big change. That's a big difference. Yeah. And I think, you know, we see folks making these big changes, and there's always the kind of social media comparison side of it. You see only the pretty parts of a transition. So, you know, with all your insights to kind of the good, the bad, the ugly, what do you think people get wrong around some of these bigger career transitions, especially that we've seen over the last few years?
I find it's unrealistic expectations, if I had to summarize it. They often say, oh, look, Stephanie made this transition. All of a sudden, there's this program up, and people don't realize all the work and effort that goes into it. Or, oh, this person landed a job at Amazon, and people forget to look, okay, here's the degree that they have, or all the experience that went into that, or their certification, or the networking. Oftentimes people just see that end result, that highlight reel, as some people call it, and don't see everything else that went into it. And when we take media, social media into account, the only things that are being posted oftentimes on LinkedIn are, here, yay, I got a job, or I'm really struggling with the job search. So people have a false perception of what it takes to switch careers, start a business, launch a brand, whatever it might be. So I think having a really clear understanding of what you're up against can be really helpful and empowering to know kind of, here's what that trajectory is going to look like for me.
Oh, I love that. I'm a very visual person. So I almost think, you know, when we see someone's life journey or career journey, we're not seeing the day-to-day journey. Mm-hmm. We see the landmarks, the good landmarks, even some of the bad, challenging landmarks. You know, I love that there's a shift in our culture around sharing some of the not so great, some of the ugly, but there's still all of that in the middle. Mm-hmm. And it can be some of the really boring stuff. Like, let me tell you, I do my own accounting.
Yep.
I'm probably never going to share about doing my own accounting on social media. So I love that, you know, example that you're only kind of seeing the highlight reel and taking that into consideration when you're considering a transition. Mm-hmm. I also love that it's a great point about leveraging a coach or another resource for a big transition, because then that individual, someone like yourself, can actually help you navigate those things that aren't so visible and help you consider that.
Yeah, there's so many steps in a job search. I'm visual as well. A lot of my clients want to map it out. I also work with a lot of engineers or product folks say, can we map it all out? I said, yes, let's please. Every single step that goes into this job search, the 20, 30 steps, it's not just applying, but it's clarifying the companies. It's determining your target salary. Mm-hmm. It's writing the resume. It's the LinkedIn. It's each interview, it's prepping for the interviews. There's so many steps that people don't always realize. So it can be helpful to map those out. And then for those with trauma in particular, to say, here's where I'm in control. Here's where I have autonomy, where I can empower myself to then go through and improve my job search efforts, can be a really powerful technique.
I love that. I think that's so powerful. This is an interesting question. It's kind of a loaded question because I know there's no easy answer. So I will say that up front so you don't have to be like, geez, Stephanie, come on. But What types of trauma or what types of situations do you find yourself hearing about more frequently? Or do you see kind of a common theme around the traumatic experiences people are bringing with them, you know, from the workplace or to kind of the job search transition point in their lives?
I love that you said the ones I'm hearing, because a lot of times I'm not hearing about them, or they may come up in our fifth or sixth session. Often workplace trauma, so it could be a boss who is difficult or bullying or something like that, or a coworker. So I'm a career coach, so a lot of it's kind of career-related trauma. Yes. That's the most common. Something that's been interesting, a lot of people who have been cult survivors have been reaching out to me and just understanding what does it look like as you look for a job and having to realize or normalize kind of being able to speak back to someone, or like understanding, yes, you can negotiate a salary, or yes, you can challenge someone, for example, is something that comes up a lot. Sometimes it's people who have been divorced or separated from an abusive partner, and then realizing, oh, I have these beliefs, and beliefs are kind of our past thoughts that may not align with my values, is which I currently believe is true to me, and saying, okay, this is a misalignment. So those are some of the most common. It varies so much, but those are some of the ones that come up with clients.
That's so interesting. It's especially, I mean, workplace trauma, absolutely. That makes sense. And then certainly, you know, survivors of intimate partner violence, intimate partner emotional abuse, all of those things, financial abuse. I would expect that. That makes total sense to me. The cult survivors is really interesting. And I'm going to try not to rabbit hole too much. I'm fascinated. I read this amazing book a couple of years ago. It's called Cultish, The Language of Cults. It's by Amanda Montel. And it's all about language and how we use language to basically manipulate people and the language of cults. And the reason I thought of that, and the reason I thought about, wow, what an interesting, like, how smart to leverage someone who can help support you, because organizations can get a little culty too.
Yes.
And some of the language, some of the manipulation, that's absolutely there. I mean, I've used the term before. I'm sure we've heard the term used before, you know, with a leader who has a big personality, kind of the cult of personality around a leader. And how, I mean, I cannot even begin to imagining how triggering, how difficult to navigate the workplace could become then for someone who is a survivor of a cult experience. That is, we could have a whole separate podcast.
And it's more common than I've recognized as well. It's just an area I wasn't very knowledgeable on, and it's been super formal cults. Sometimes it's people identified their religion as a cult. So it's been interesting to see how that impacts every part of their career journey. Sometimes people feel like, oh, why is it so difficult to write my resume? It's just a document. And then they realize all these pieces of their trauma are coming up, of their lived experience are coming up, and they don't realize sometimes, at least initially, oh, this is actually not just the resume that's difficult. It's all these other pieces under the surface. How do I tend to that?
I think what you've said is incredibly poignant. And even in thinking about your own kind of career journey, when we talk about resumes, especially, you know, former HR leader, we talk about resumes a lot, and it's kind of this assumed thing. But if we really peel back, we're asking people to write their own identity, even if it's just their professional identity, write their own identity down on a piece of paper. And that's wild. I mean, that's wild. That is, I mean, it's really challenging. And I think it's a lot of the reason many, many people struggle with writing their own resume, because it requires a lot of self-awareness. There can be a lot to unpack there. Yeah. There are things that you need to do to successfully execute a resume that can be really uncomfortable, be especially uncomfortable if that is colored by experiences of trauma, like you've said. So fascinating.
Yeah, and it's something that just came up more and more as I was working with people, and they say, oh, I'm not supposed to take credit for this, or this is something, this environment was so difficult, I just want to forget about it. And it can be a lot of reliving that past trauma. And the same with interviewing. When you go into interview, you have to relive all these stories. It's language that can be difficult mm-hmm. if you're not used to talking about yourself, or you don't want to talk about yourself, or you want to distance yourself from this past mm-hmm. experience. It can bring up a lot. And again, my job isn't to process that with people, but instead to help them regulate those emotions, yes. those feelings, those sensations that come up, and say, okay, how do we navigate this in a way that protects you and also helps you with your goal of landing that job?
Absolutely. Oh, I love that. I would also, you know, given your perspective, And knowing that many of the folks who listen in on the podcast are HR professionals, talent professionals, even leaders, if, you know, you're on the other side of the hiring, we'll call mm-hmm. it the hiring process. And I highlight here, there is a huge power imbalance that we're navigating mm-hmm. in that process as well. You know, what advice do you have for recruiters, talent leaders, HR leaders, hiring managers, about how they can be a little bit more thoughtful and maybe be a little more trauma-informed mm-hmm. as they're approaching, you know, potential new team members?
A few things come up. The first is just asking what accommodations, if any, yeah. people need. I think that can be really simple yet powerful and demonstrate that that's something that your organization cares about and values. The other thing is recognizing the tone of the conversation or the dynamics of that conversation. Sometimes people like doing rapid fire questions. And depending on the role, that might be necessary, but oftentimes that's not necessary. People aren't going to be in regular conversations where it's going to be rapid fire, where they have to respond really quickly right away. So saying, okay, is this really the best way to assess this talent? Or is there a different way? Do I need to be kind of going, rattling off questions? Or can I slow it down a bit to allow this person to think, to process, to regulate themselves in a way that's going to be more similar to how their day-to-day work is? Unless your organization really does do that and tries to like be on the offense with fellow employees, maybe you're not actually giving them an experience that allows them to show them their best selves and how they're going to be at work. I think oftentimes it's an interrogation or a deposition, yes. the interview. Yes. It doesn't need to be. It can be a collaboration. It can Absolutely. Be more of a conversation.
Oh, I love that. Absolutely. And I think there's an important point here about interviews. We can get, especially HR professionals, I'm going to call myself out a little bit here. I feel like I'm a fantastic interviewer. I've been doing it my whole career. Mm-hmm. It's something I've practiced and practiced and practiced. As part of my work, and it's kind of on both sides of the coin, but we can always get better. We can always mm-hmm. learn new information. We can always change what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And there was a great post I saw, you know, a couple months ago. It stuck with me, and it was about how do we better support neurodiverse, specifically neurodiverse candidates. It was mm-hmm. like, send the questions ahead of time. Like, it's that mm-hmm. simple. Like, send the questions ahead of time, like give them time to consider and review this. And I was like, Stephanie 5 years ago would be like, absolutely not. I am not doing that. That is ridiculous. They're going to have canned answers, blah, 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 this and that. And in that moment, I called myself out. I was like, I would have said no to this, but this is absolutely like, we have more information. We mm-hmm. know we can do better. This isn't that hard. Like, why wouldn't we make a change and do something different? And I think, you know, in addition to what you said, I think also for those of us who do have, at least in this moment, in this relationship with a candidate for a job that they want, and being, you know, one of those people that has a say in whether or not they're hired, in that moment where you have so much more power, I think it is our duty to do more, learn more, be willing to change, to do better. And not just stick with, hey, I'm actually really good at this. I don't need to do better. I don't need to change. Like, no, we can always do better. No, we can always like learn more mm-hmm. and find ways to be more inclusive and honestly end up getting more and better candidates because of those changes we make as well.
What I imagine listeners will think is, well, the workplace, you're not going to get your questions ahead of time. And I would disagree. In most cases I've worked and where my clients work, tech folks, they do have agendas ahead of time. Most meetings, if not all meetings, at least good ones, you're going to have an agenda ahead of time. You're going to know what's discussed. Mm-hmm. A lot of organizations won't even let you have meetings without an agenda. So mm-hmm. yes, you may be asked follow-up questions, but at sure. least giving people an agenda, topics, those initial questions can be so powerful. So people don't feel like, I have to prepare a 10 or 20 year career summary and answer any question. You're at least allowing them to focus and prepare. And if you're worried about canned answers, ask follow-up questions, dive yes. in deeper on questions related to at least topics you're giving them. A lot of my clients, when they go interview at these tech companies recognize a way to be more inclusive is to say, here's the three topics we're going to cover. Here's yes. the types of questions we're going to ask. They may not give the exact question, but at least some samples. And it's so much easier for my clients, whether they've had trauma, they're neurodiverse, they just need more time to process, to then show up as their best selves.
And I think too, you know, I think you actually end up getting better answers when you give folks an opportunity to prepare. I think a traditional like gotcha interview, also if you're like playing like gotcha in interviews, like maybe do some self-reflection. But yes. like those typical like think on your feet interviews, for someone who is a fast thinker, who wants to go, who wants to move fast, they're great because that's their natural talent. Mm. That's their natural skill set. That's their ability. But then you are creating an issue in your team because you have a bunch of fast, quick thinkers instead uh-huh. of deep thinkers. Uh-huh. And so, again, this is another aspect of diversity of uh-huh. thought and approach where we can really solve for it and also be more inclusive and more trauma-informed. Like, uh-huh. it's funny how that works out, that by doing the right thing, we also get better business outcomes. Yeah. I love it when it lines up that way because shockingly, it almost always does.
It does. Yeah. And when you're more inclusive, you're often more trauma-informed as well, and vice yes. versa. They go yes. hand in hand so much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree. One thing I would love to chat with you about is, you know, thinking about how tricky it is, how tough it is navigating a big career transition, especially, you know, there are a lot of folks out there who are navigating a career transition that perhaps wasn't their choice with the layoffs we've seen over the course of the last 3 years. So I would love to chat with you about ideas, recommendations for self-care or self-support for folks experiencing mm-hmm. a career transition, thinking about a career transition, going through one right now. And my always PSA whenever I talk about self-care is, we're not just talking about, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow, goopy green juice and massages. Some of this is, you know, hard work, tricky work, things we maybe don't want to do, but it's important to maintain our sense of self, our sense of self-efficacy, and our mental health overall.
I think that's what's key, what you said. It's more than just those kind of surface level things. One of my own friends who's a coach and a mentor, she said, when your phone dies, you don't just leave it there, but you actually plug it in and you need something to charge it. So there's some sort of something that's needed to charge you up and support yourself. So if you've been laid off, if you've been fired, if you're looking for something new, you want to figure out what's going to charge you up and fill you. It's not going to be, it might be part of it might just be laying there because your phone's may be laying there as you're charging it, but there's other things that need to charge you, and finding those that work for you is really key, and knowing that they're going to be different for different people. However, the thing that's I found common for everyone is finding a community of support, yes. surrounding you with people who uplift you. Oftentimes people want to go just with fellow job seekers, which can be helpful, but I'd be mindful that the people around you are uplifting you and empowering you and supporting you, and not just rose-colored glasses, but are being helpful and not dragging you down and saying, maybe this is actually someone I don't want to listen to, or maybe I don't want to be doom scrolling. But instead, that support, I found, if it could only be one thing you did to practice self-care, it'd be finding and surrounding yourself with people who are going to uplift and empower you through the job search.
Because again, that sense of community is so important, that sense of peer support. And I think you're right on there. It is unfortunately really easy to kind of slip into, oh, I'm never going to find a job. Mm-hmm. This is so hard. Everything's stacked up against me. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to be realistic. Mm-hmm. I'm a big believer in being realistic about the situations we're facing, mm-hmm. the environments we're in. I think it's helpful. But I also think there is a way to balance that realism with, hey, what are some positive actions I can take? Where are areas of my life I do have control? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a much more, you know, trauma-informed approach than going, hey, let's get together and feel bad for ourselves. You can feel bad for yourself every once in a while. I indulge in that quite frequently. But it's about how do we move forward, mm-hmm. and what can we do from there? So I love that. Where would you recommend folks go to find that sense of community? This is, again, a really hard question I've tossed at you. But let's see what you come up with.
Yeah, part of being a coach, people assume you can't go in the past as a coach, which is false. Part of it is, we're not processing the past, but I would look in your past and say, mm-hmm. Who has been helpful, or where have there been situations where you've struggled or it's been difficult and people have been helpful and have energized you or uplifted you? So I would do that to start and say, these are people that actually I felt like I could count on, and they were helpful during these situations. And you might even make a list of, these are people that kind of drained me or zapped my energy. I want to minimize my contact with them. Maybe when I contact my mom, she just keeps saying to find it. This isn't my mom. I love my mom and she's the energy booster. But let's say when you contact your mom, like, she's like, you need to find a job. You need to do this. You need to do this. Yeah. So maybe that's someone on your minimizer list. Or maybe you have a friend, you're like, oh, every time I talk, it's great. We go to brunch and it's helpful. And this is just really fills my phone battery. It really makes me excited to look for a job. So I would go in the past and see if there's any people who have been uplifting. My other thing that I would be remiss not to mention is LinkedIn. I am not a fan of just going and scrolling through there for job seekers. It can be information overload, and it's not customized to you. Instead, I would go find people who are in your target role at your target companies and reach out to them and say, hey, I'm looking for a role. What insights do you have? I'd love to learn about your experience. I'm trying to make a pivot into engineering at Meta, and I see that you did that as well. Can you tell me about your experience? Because that then gives you insights from people who have already made that transition happen. And that's often going to be an energy boost as you're looking for that next role. And it can give you hope as well, which is so critical during the job search.
I love that so much. And I love that advice because people love talking about their work.
Yes.
People love sharing. And if you're genuinely interested in the work they're doing, like you will have the most amazing conversations. Mm-hmm. And it took me longer than it should have to realize this in my career. But I actually realized this when I transitioned into supporting a construction organization. I was like, oh my gosh, like, this is intense. This work is really interesting. And my leader was like, go ask questions, go feel stupid, like you don't know what you're talking about, and go ask questions. And my God, I had the best conversations and built the best relationships subsequently with those individuals because they were excited to talk about what they do. And I mean, what a, like you said, what a boost to talk to someone who's excited about the work they do and then also potentially build a genuine relationship there versus the, like, people I think sometimes with LinkedIn are like grossed out, or when we talk about like networking events are grossed out because it feels icky. And if you go into networking events or networking conversations with, hey, how can I get something out of this person? Yeah, it does feel icky. When you go because you're being curious, you want to learn more, you want to build genuine relationships, it's amazing and it's magical. And just like you said, it works.
It does. And people are willing to help if you have a clear call to action. You make it easy for them to help you. And you may not get responses from everyone.
Sure.
But when people are job searching, I would focus on what's in your control. Not, I'm going to speak to 10 people, but I'm going to contact 10 people. And then what happens, happens. And keep focusing on what you can control throughout that job search process.
Oh, I love that so much. I also love that you noted, hey, go back and think about people who energized you in the past or people who made you feel good. I think you can apply apply that to a lot of things when you mm-hmm. consider self-care or self-support. Mm-hmm. Like, what do I do that makes me feel good? What do I mm-hmm. eat that makes me feel good? What do I do or eat mm-hmm. that makes me feel like crap? And really use that as, that's an easy way to reflect and say, here are things I can do that make me feel good. Mm-hmm. Here are things I do that make me feel not so good. And can I build from there in a real simple way?
And with your job search, what's been helpful in the past with your job search? What didn't work? When you prepped for interviews, what worked? What didn't work? So doing that really assessment of your past can be supportive as you move forward.
So if folks are considering making a big career pivot, mm-hmm. making a career transition, or maybe even just, you know, thinking about going and starting to look for a new role, what is kind of your best advice for folks before they get started, or maybe for folks who are mm-hmm. just kind of diving in?
I would get clear on what you want. Set a rubric or some parameters about what's important. Oftentimes, once people go looking, they get really excited and say, well, here's this. It's that shiny penny syndrome. And instead, before you start looking or applying for jobs, I would say, here's what's really important to me. Is it work-life balance? Is it salary? Is it remote or hybrid work? Is it the title? Is it in a certain industry? Like, why are you switching? Write all that down. So then later, when you get offered an interview, when you get job offers, you can reflect back before you got really excited about this opportunity, before you have something in front of you and say, okay, when I was feeling more regulated, here's what I truly wanted. And what I didn't want, were there deal breakers? So spend time writing that out, and then know that it's going to change as you do research, as you network and talk with people, as you interview, that list might change. But I encourage people, I think of it like sitting in the car, kind of before you start driving, you want to sit in the car and program your GPS so you don't end up at Disney World. And then you're like, actually, we wanted to go to Disneyland. You don't want to waste your time like driving, end up at the wrong destination and not be where you end up really wanted to be.
I love that example so much because it's like, think about it, Disneyland and Disney World, way different locations, mm-hmm. way different journeys, mm-hmm. but pretty easy if you're not careful what you're programming in to end up at the wrong destination. So I think that is fantastic. I also want to zero in on, you know, you referenced folks come to you and they have, you know, past traumatic experience. Mm-hmm. And some of those are workplace-based traumatic mm-hmm. experiences. And I'm sure some of the folks who are listening in have experienced trauma in the workplace. I know I sure have. How do you advise folks consider, you know, that previous experience and then how they navigate the job search, be it, you know, avoiding re-traumatizing themselves, avoiding mm-hmm. triggers, and maybe avoiding organizations or roles mm-hmm. that are going to kind of grind up against that previous experience or be something that potentially exacerbates that experience of trauma for them?
That list that we mentioned can be really helpful in saying, what is important to me in my next job? Is it that I have autonomy? Is it that my boss isn't a micromanager? Like developing that list. And oftentimes people's list, especially if they've had a really traumatic environment, informs what they look for in that next job. And then the next step is saying, okay, great. I don't want a boss who's micromanaging or narcissistic or whatever it might be. How are you going to evaluate for that? How are you going to assess that? Okay, great. That's what you want. But how are you going to assess or evaluate for that? Is it going to be going on Team Blind or Reddit and reading reviews? Is it going to be during the interview process? Are there certain questions you're going to ask? So it might even be a tea table where you say, here's what's important to me. And then here's the questions I'm going to ask or the ways I'm going to evaluate this. Is it going to be reaching out to former employees on LinkedIn or using, I love LinkedIn, using it to see the average tenure of employees in this department? So then determining how you're going to evaluate and assess for it. And then if you get an offer, if you have questions still unanswered before you just sign and they say, hey, what other questions? You can go back to your list and say, actually, there's a few things I didn't get covered or didn't get answered during the interview process. Can I ask these questions before I sign?
Absolutely. And companies you want to be part of will be willing to answer questions mm-hmm. for you. They're not going to hide mm-hmm. things. 100%.
And I find oftentimes when people are interviewing, sometimes they're a little afraid to ask those more difficult or challenging questions. You'll be asked behavioral questions, but you can also ask those of your manager as well. Let's say your last organization, the change, they weren't good about communicating change. You could ask your manager, can you tell me about a recent change that happened at the organization and how you supported employees? You can ask your boss for examples or your prospective boss for examples as well. So I think it's really important that you do your due diligence and you're not afraid to ask those questions.
I love that. I like how you frame the questions too, because I think sometimes it can be tricky to figure out what we are looking for and what we aren't looking for. Like, it's easy to say, I don't want to work for a micromanager. Mm-hmm. Well, yes, but no one's going to be like, yes, I'm a micromanager as a boss. No, I promise you, no one's going to tell you that in an interview. If they do, run. But I really think there are ways we can ask ourselves questions, or we can ask better questions during the interview that really helps us get to that. And one of my favorite questions to ask in an interview is actually a great tool I've used with folks on how to think about what management style works best for them. Mm. And it's, who's your favorite manager you've ever worked with and why? Tell me why they're your favorite. And dig into that more and dig into that deeper and understand, hey, these are the things that really stood out to me. Mm-hmm. And I like that. And then can you ask questions about, you know, support or being challenged or whatever it is that stood out to you? And then do the same thing with, who's your least favorite leader you've ever worked with? And then the why, and then the digging in. So you can really get to, here are the things that worked well for me that are specific. And here are the things that didn't work well for me that are specific. And then you can find ways to ask questions about that. Like you said, tell me about the last time your team navigated a change, where you can ask a question where there's not a expected answer. Like, everyone knows you're not supposed to say you're a micromanager. Yeah. Everyone knows you're not supposed to say you're very controlling as a leader, but there are ways to kind of dig deeper, know more about what you want, so you can ask better questions to find out if that's going to be a match.
Yeah. And I love that. I think those open-ended questions can be really powerful where there's not an expected answer. A lot of my clients struggle around delegation because they're executives being delegated work. And they say, tell me about how you delegate, or how do you like to receive updates? Just those simple questions can give a lot of insight as to that management style and relationship. I love these too, your favorite manager and why, and your least favorite manager and why. I wrote these down to share with clients.
I love them. And I ask everyone, and it's not a gotcha question. It's really, I want to find out how you enjoy being managed. And I think this is, there's the matchmaking of a job with, do you meet the credentials, the skills, qualifications, the education, all the, the stuff, the check boxes. Interviewers, organizations can get really good at kind of the matchmaking aspect is finding that person that work naturally is going to work really well with you. Or barring that, as a manager, at least find out, how your individual would like to be managed. Like, get an insight into that. So you go, oh, this person wants to, meet once a day and check in on their priorities, or this person doesn't want to talk to me unless they have a question. Like, those are two wildly different employees and they may have very similar resumes. So love that. Love these questions. And yes, anyone feel free to steal those questions for interviews. They're for everyone and they are super interesting. Sometimes you get real interesting answers too. I'm like, you don't have to name names. We're like, I'm going to name a name.
But good for you. A lot. I imagine it tells you so much and gives you so many insights and examples.
It does. And it's and watching someone kind of light up when they talk about the best leader they've worked with is also just really fulfilling as well. Yep. It's like, oh, this is amazing. So very helpful. Well, Kyle, this has been such an incredible conversation. I feel like we could talk for hours longer, but want to be respectful of your time, our listeners' time. I also want to give you a chance, and I want our listeners to have an opportunity, if they are looking to navigate a career transition, if they are looking for opportunities to, work with you, maybe just follow your work, where can they find you? How can they connect with you?
Yes, my website, caffeinatedkyle.com, is a good place. And I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn, Kyle Elliott with two L's and two T's.
Awesome. Amazing. Kyle, this is such important work. I am so grateful you're doing it. I am so grateful you've taken the time to chat with us today. And I am sure we will be chatting with you again in the future. And everyone, thank you so much for listening in. Until next time, be well.